Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
The Guardian.
In this election, you, the American people, reminded us that while our road has been hard, while our journey has been long, we have picked ourselves up. We have fought our way back. And we know in our hearts that for the United States of America, the best is yet to come.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. 4 more years, but of what? As Barack Obama is returned to the White House, we'll look at how he broke the curse of incumbency in the financial crisis. What lessons for economically hit leaders elsewhere? Our team of experts take a deep breath and consider what the result means for the economy, America's position in the world, and for its poisonous internal politics. Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian columnist Hadley Freeman, The Observer's foreign affairs editor Peter Beaumont, and The Guardian's economics editor Larry Elliott. A warm welcome to you all. So, in the end, the polls were right. The result was settled just before midnight in the swing state of Ohio, home to much of the car industry that President Obama helped to save. It dropped into the president's column and the race was over. Hadley, no euphoria this time, but after 4 years of being encumbered with office, it was arguably a kind of more impressive win than last time around.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there was a lot of euphoria because now people aren't starry-eyed about Obama necessarily. They know the limitations that he has to work within and also that he is human. He's not going to be the great savior. He's not going to be Mandela, Jesus, and Martin Luther King in one person. But the fact that it was such a statement that people are still behind him, even after the recession, even after a lot of disillusionment in him, despite Guantanamo Bay still being open, despite the drone attacks in Pakistan and Afghanistan, people still support him. And it was a real statement against the Republicans. I mean, we can talk about how there's a vote for Obama, but it was largely also a vote against Mitt Romney.
Do you think more the second?
I think probably. I mean, the Republican Party is so stupid on so many levels because all they needed to do was go slightly more, well, to go moderate, to go slightly to the right of Obama. There were so many disillusioned people, disillusioned former Obama supporters. If they just had someone who was reasonable, who wasn't talking so much social conservatism, who wasn't so kowtowing to the far right of his party, I think he would have picked up a lot more people.
It's interesting. I looked at the Republican platform yesterday, you know, what we'd call the manifesto, and it does read very, very differently from, say, a conservative English manifesto in that it's some... there's lots of religious, like, language in it. It's a different sort of...
I mean, and also, by the end of that campaign, the Republican platform seemed to be basically no federal support for states that had been attacked by hurricanes, but we're okay with different kinds of rape. Boiled down, that seemed to be what the Republicans were saying in the week before the election, which was quite an extraordinary thing to say, really.
Although, Peter, I mean, we don't have a card-carrying Republican here to put the other view, but you know they sort of did try and moderate things a bit, didn't they? And Romney had some success with that in the first debate.
Yeah, except I think that the problem has been a political one as much as one about the policies. I mean, they've had, and Republicans admit this, they've had 6 months to know exactly how Obama was going to pitch his stall. And Romney didn't seem to respond to that. And they've also known for a long time how the demographics in the United States are going. I mean, you know, support for Republicans has been dropping off. I mean, support for both parties has, but for Republicans more than for Democrats. And you read some of the readouts from Republicans this morning, and they're saying, you know, we've hit a demographic wall. We have cornered the market in sort of white 40-year-old plus men, and no one else really likes us. And this is not just an important issue for us now. They're saying it's an existential issue for the future of the Republican Party.
Gosh, so, I mean, normally it takes a lot to shake Republican certainty, doesn't it? But you're saying this result might have done that.
I mean, the New York Times has been very interesting this morning. They went to one of the Virginia suburbs that swung quite heavily towards the Democrats. Democrats, and you know, they've been talking to an awful lot of people who are Republican campaigners, from sort of, you know, lieutenant generals and other political activists, and they're just saying, oh, it's been bad politics as well as sort of bad policies that they've been trying to push.
I mean, Fox News kind of summed it up on the night when Bill O'Reilly, who's their sort of pope in chief, was on, and he said that basically that traditional America was gone, that there were now more minorities. And those minorities he characterized as Hispanics, Black, and women, which came as a surprise to this woman. And that these minorities wanted things, they wanted stuff, and therefore they were going to Obama. So in other words, their view is that the real America has been stolen by these suspicious people who want things like health care and good education and to not be forced to learn about creationism. And that's their view, is that it's not the Republican Party's fault, it's America's fault for changing.
So it's obviously all to play for in terms of which way they leap, whether they go further to the extremes or not. But Larry, I mean, away from the specifics of the issue, you've looked around the world the last 4 years and seen government after government getting booted out. I think Angela Merkel's about the only one who hung on before this. And of course, the German economy did better than many others. Were you surprised by the result?
I wasn't surprised by the result. I think Obama did buck the trend, that's for sure. I think that the reason he did buck the trend was that the election in America probably wasn't about the economy. It was about other things. It was about immigration. It was about women's issues. I think that had it been solely about the economy, then Obama would have gone the way of Gordon Brown and Nicolas Sarkozy and all the other leaders who've got their marching orders from the electorate. So, I mean, most of the polls showed that the majority of Americans thought the economy was in relatively bad shape and thought, to the extent they did think about it, that Romney had a better plan than Obama, which wouldn't have been difficult since Obama didn't have very much of a plan at all. But the fact is that Romney blew it. He should have won that election. I mean, unemployment is the highest it's been for any president who's won an election since Roosevelt in the 1930s, which really just goes to show what a complete horlicks the Republicans made of it. They should have won, and they didn't.
So that's a unanimous vote from around the table that the problem was more with the Republicans than anything else. But the Republicans didn't lose all the elections this week. They came back in the majority in the House of Representatives. Earlier, I spoke to The Observer's US correspondent, Paul Harris, about what had happened on Capitol Hill and how much had changed.
Despite hundreds of millions of dollars being poured into those races over the last year, it really is, the more it changes, the more it stays the same. Very little has actually emerged to change the status quo. We went into the election with the Republicans in control of the House and the Democrats in control of the Senate, and we emerged with the Republicans in control of the House and the Democrats in control of the Senate. So not much has changed there, which is probably not great news, as the status quo has not been very effective in dealing with some of the very serious policy issues that America faces. Washington's always known for gridlock, and I don't think this election is going to change that very much.
We remember Barack Obama, 2008, great new dawn, and then he'd got briefly a Democratic House of Representatives as well as a Democratic, more securely Democratic Senate than he's got today. Even so, he struggled very badly to get his healthcare legislation through in diluted form. Do you think we can assume he'll get almost nothing through this time, or do you think he'll have learnt lessons that will help him start to get some traction?
Well, I think the answer to that question lies really in the mind of Barack Obama. But my opinion is that he is probably unlikely to be any more effective. I think Obama has shown himself to be someone who is extremely tolerant of Republican excesses and has a great desire, for probably political as well as personal reasons, to sort of reach across the aisle and to be a uniter and to be conciliatory. But I just don't see the other side reacting well to that. They haven't in the past. I don't think the Republican Party is going to have any sort of sudden revelation that it needs to move to the center. You know, they maintain control of the House of Representatives, which a few people thought they wouldn't be able to do as they're so radical. But in fact, they've actually been electorally rewarded for that radicalism, which I don't think, from their point of view, is a mandate to reach out and shake Obama's hand. So I really don't see much sort of prospect that gridlock I was talking about a little bit about earlier is going to change. I just think it's going to pretty much stay the same. I think there's going to be a lot of conflict to come.
Oh dear, oh dear, Hadley. So it's not going to be any easier dealing with the Republicans and with Capitol Hill than it was last time, Paul Harris is saying. if President Obama is going to get stuff done, he is, however, going to have to find a way of getting a majority by perhaps breaking off a few more moderate Republicans. And he's also going to have to pick and choose, isn't he, what he wants to legislate on. Mm-hmm. What areas do you think, if you were him, you'd be looking to...
Well, in his acceptance or his victory speech, I guess, he already mentioned climate change, which is something he's kind of avoided throughout his first term. And there was a piece on the New Yorker website yesterday saying that basically Obama had started planning his second campaign in December 08. So he's always been looking forward to this moment. I think now he can let go of that and he can be a bit more bullish about issues that he knew would be unpopular with a Republican electorate. So definitely climate change, definitely healthcare, gay marriage.
That's healthcare, you think more stuff on healthcare?
I think he really saw that as his main thing when he arrived in office. A lot of people thought he should have focused on the economy first. He focused on the healthcare. I think he still has, that's a really important issue for him, and I think he'll still really keep pushing that forward. And he's, you know, he says he's not ashamed of the name Obamacare. He's proud of it. So he can let go of all those concerns about how the Republicans react to, a Republican electorate reacts to it. Gay marriage, definitely. I think the way the Republicans talked about women's rights and contraceptive rights has sort of solidified in his mind that he wants to focus on that as well. But I think climate change is going to be his big thing.
And so climate change, we'd be having legislation potentially as part of an international deal, but it's only one of several areas in which he'd also be looking to do new deals with governments around the world. Again, he's going to have to pick and choose, though, isn't he? He can't do climate change and Palestine and the trade round. Where do you think he'll put his priority?
Well, I think his biggest foreign policy issue is actually going to be around Afghanistan and Pakistan. I mean, there's supposed to be a drawdown by 2014 in Afghanistan. He has to negotiate that in some way without causing more problems in Pakistan, I think. And I think he's aware that both things that have been tried in Pakistan, both sort of, you know, the drone warfare and also the Pakistani government's own attempts to do peace deals in the federally administered tribal areas have both failed and actually caused more militancy. And I think that is one issue he's going to have to focus on. I mean, I think I suspect that for the next couple of months at least, Israel-Palestine will be on the back burner until he sees what the shape of the next Israeli government is.
And when's the election there?
That's early next year. So yeah, I think that will be on the back burner, and he'll see whether it's possible to do more with that. I mean, I would kind of slightly wanted to come back to the point that Paul was making on his issues with Congress. I mean, it's worth remembering that Congress has got a much, much, much lower level of public approval than he has as an individual. And he will have seen his election as being something of a mandate. And I think there will be Republicans who will be thinking about where they're going to be in 4 years' time, who are going to want to actually not get blamed for pushing America off the fiscal cliff. I mean, and so I think that perhaps there might be more movement than some people anticipate.
So do you think, specifically in terms of the House, where you've got this majority caucus from the Republicans, do you think that there might be a, you know, a couple of dozen or whatever it would take, representatives there who'll be worried about their own, saving their own skins in 2 years' time, and therefore be ready to talk turkey with Obama?
Well, I mean, John Boehner's already said that he wants to offer an olive branch. I mean, it's a fairly tatty olive branch at the moment that he's offering. But, I mean, you know, I think it was significant that both the House and Senate leaders were both talking about trying to find sort of, you know, a negotiated grand bargain to go forward with. And I suspect there will be other people who want to attach themselves to that because, you know, both sides lose from the kind of gridlock and political failure. And I suspect some people are going to look at it and think, well, actually, we have to be seen as doing something rather than making people's situations worse.
I mean, just looking outside, sorry, I mean, with Chris Christie right before the election, he's somebody
who's
New Jersey governor. He suddenly crossed over from being sort of Mitt Romney's vague cheerleader. He was allegedly the contender for the VP. He gave a speech at the Republican convention. Suddenly he was pairing up with Obama, and he saw it again with Mike Bloomberg. And the thing with Christie is that a lot of people think that he's got his eye on his re-election in, I think, 2014. But also he realizes that the Republican Party, I reckon, is just so far to the right that if Christie was to run for president in 2016, as a lot of people think he will, that he just has to get away from that far right and move back to the centre.
Larry, we'll come back to the fiscal cliff in a moment, but in terms of the international diplomacy side of things, normally the emphasis on for a second term president, what about international trade? Nothing much happened in Obama's first term. We know something would have happened if Romney would have won, because he'd have called China a currency manipulator on day one. Do you think he's going to try and do anything there, or do you think his heart's not really in it?
I suspect that they'll tone down the rhetoric. Obama also turned up the rhetoric on China during the campaign, partly in response to what Romney was doing. I think he'll probably turn down the rhetoric pretty soon. After all, you know, China buys an awful lot of American debt, and so has a whip hand over America to that extent. So I don't think Obama will want to be involved in some big trade war with China. And the other big issue is whether Obama tries to breathe new life into the Doha international trade talks, which have been going on since 2001, are effectively dead in the water unless Washington decides to do something about them. I suspect he won't do very much about them, because he'd have to use a lot of political capital to get those talks up and running again. And I think he'll have other things on his mind. I think that, you know, trade is going to be well down the list of Obama's priorities, and it will just get squeezed out by other issues.
Okay, well, we know that one issue that he's going to have to deal with this Congress very quickly is this so-called fiscal cliff that looms at the end of the year. It threatens to tip the US economy into recession, some say, and drag others down with it. But what is it? I asked Russ Roberts, who's of Stanford University's Hoover Institution.
The fiscal cliff is the result of kicking the can down the road, which was the result of the 2001 Bush tax cuts, which were not permanent. They were designed to last for 10 years, or at least that's what they could get approved when it was passed. And then when it was time for them to either be extended permanently or disappear, Congress and the president agreed to extend them for another year. So we're now at a point where I think as of December 31st, if there nothing else happens, those tax cuts will expire. So there will be an across the board increase in tax rates for all tax paying Americans. And there will be put into place across the board expenditure cuts. Those two steps both would reduce the deficit, at least that would be the plan. But that is apparently such an ominous thought as a way to deal with it that it's called the fiscal cliff. So there is this sort of weird period now between the new members of Congress coming in. There are not very many of them, but there will be a new Congress, new members of both the House and the Senate in the United States. And until then, there's a possibility that to avert this increase in taxes and reduction in expenditures, the current Congress could negotiate with the president and come up with an agreement to avoid it. But it might not happen. And I want to say, I'm not sure it's a disaster if it does happen. It's called the fiscal cliff. I don't think it's necessarily a disaster or a fiscal calamity. It might be a good thing. So it's the automatic nature of it, I think, that makes people uneasy.
But isn't it the scale of it as well? I mean, everyone knows America's got a big problem of debt that needs to be repaid at some point. But trying to repay it so rapidly, trying to cut spending by several percentage points of GDP all in one year, isn't that a problem?
I don't know. It depends if you're a Keynesian or not. You know, if you're a Keynesian, it's a disaster. It would reduce aggregate demand. That worldview presumes that taxpayers currently are unaware that their taxes are going to be higher at some point anyway. They are. We've spent in the United States a lot more than we've taken in over the last few years and years before that. And as a result, we don't have a balanced budget. We have rising interest rate charges that will get worse if interest rates rise. But the amount we owe each year is quite large. And it's not clear that people aren't already prepared for it. The fact that the government spends less, I don't view as necessarily a bad thing. And particularly if it spends the money poorly, the Keynesians counter and say, but that'll put us into a recession. We may go into recession anyway. We don't really know.
And if that, okay, I mean, so you're saying don't panic as the mainstream is panicking. If most of the cuts are due to come from government spending, which is, of course, what the House would want, can you just talk us through the big areas where there's scope for economies? Because there's Medicaid and Social Security, presumably the president would be fairly reluctant to cut into too deeply, and likewise defense on the Republican side. What does that actually leave?
Not so much. but there are some obvious things, I think, that could be cut in both of those areas. In the area of entitlements, they could be indexed to inflation in a different way than they are now. We could delay the retirement age by a small amount in the case of Social Security. while leaving the benefit levels unchanged. And certainly on defense, I think there's plenty of room for the United States to spend less on defense without reducing its security, although Republicans say otherwise. Outside of that, most of the things that are left are symbolic as much as they are significant in size.
Lastly, the other metaphor that we get here that goes with our cliff is the debt ceiling. And most of us in Britain are not clear about the distinction between the two. Is that a separate negotiation or is it the same one?
Well, most of us in America aren't clear about it either. You know, Congress has been reluctant, particularly the Republicans, to raise the debt ceiling because they want to force a decision on spending reductions rather than simply saying, well, we'll just borrow more, because they're more worried about borrowing than I think the Democrats are. And so far, the Democrats have been right, right? We've borrowed with relatively little consequence. We're borrowing at relatively low rates. The problem and risk is that that always works until it doesn't. And when it doesn't, it's very abruptly unpleasant, like going over some kind of fiscal cliff. So I think that issue is equally shrouded in uncertainty as to what the true consequence would be for the economy. But I personally don't want to find out. And I hope that the United States can find a way to get its debt down and its fiscal house in order.
So that's Russ Roberts there. And you can hear more of his excellent podcast, econtalk.org. Larry, he sounds very calm about it all, but are you?
I suppose as a tenured professor at Stanford, he probably would be quite relaxed about it. He's not going to be one of the people who lose their jobs if 4% of GDP is taken out of the American economy in one fell swoop next year. It would be catastrophic for the American economy if that happened. We've already seen what happened in the UK when the government tightened fiscal policy too aggressively, too early in the recovery. And what's plan for the US is far, far more dramatic than what happened in the UK. And 4% taken out of the economy in 1 year would lead to probably the American economy shrinking by 2 or 3% next year. That would push unemployment back towards 10% very abruptly, and it would have huge consequences for the rest of the world. I mean, it wouldn't just be a triple dip recession in the UK, but it would intensify the crisis in the Eurozone, and it would lead to real trade tensions with China, because China's already been slowing down this year and remains, you know, dependent on exports to the US market. So, and this would have profound implications for the global economy and for the US economy. And, you know, just looking around the world, all the evidence is that you have to be incredibly careful about tightening policy in such an aggressive way when economies are in such a fragile state. And I have to say that I found what we've just heard a remarkably complacent view about what is likely to happen. I mean, yes, America does need at some point to get, you know, to get to grips with its budget deficit and to get its debt levels down, but that has been done in the past, normally by growing the economy, not by cratering it with tax increases and spending cuts, which would be catastrophic for the American economy.
I mean, so the all-important question, I guess, in terms of the negotiation is how many people would agree with Russ Roberts in the Republican Party and sort of say, oh, you know, let's do this and see what happens.
Oh, well, I mean, unfortunately, quite a lot. I mean, you know, one of the main sort of strands of sort of, if you want to get Tea Party coloured thinking, is that you can cut government spending and you can keep cutting taxes ad infinitum. I mean, the issue is they are going to have to increase taxes at the moment. Taxes are at historically low levels. I mean, if you compare, you know, the top rates of taxation with former Republican presidents like Nixon or Reagan, I mean, it's very, very low. I mean, they are going to have to grasp this nettle at some stage. But I mean, I completely agree. Well, I mean, I've seen one figure suggesting that when these temporary tax cuts come to an end, it'll be an increase of $2,000, you know, for some middle class families in the amount of tax they pay. That's a big amount. I mean, in the situation we're in, no one would want to pay something like £1,500 more tax in a year.
Yeah, I know the idea that Americans are sort of sitting there and know these tax increases are coming. I mean, this is the sort of gobbledygook that economics professors come up with, the idea that people are assuming these taxes are about to go up or that spending is about to be reduced. I mean, this is the stuff of economic textbooks. It's not the stuff of real life. This will come as a profound shock to people when they see their taxes going up by this amount. I mean, it won't affect the people at the very top. The people on $250,000 plus, so for them, you know, an increase in the tax rate up to 40% will make pretty little difference. But for someone on a squeezed middle income, somewhere between $50,000 and around $50,000, to take $2,000 out of their annual income through tax increases will hurt, and it will affect their spending decisions.
Hadley, you'd have thought that because the thing that's going to happen automatically is mostly these tax rates going back up from before Bush back to some pre-Bush levels, rather than spending cuts part of the mix as well. But doesn't that put Obama in a stronger negotiating position? Because the one thing the Republicans are most keen to avoid is increases in tax.
Mm-hmm. Well, probably, yeah. I mean, the thing is, Obama was never, despite being characterized as a dangerous socialist, he wasn't really ever that left. He's very centrist, which just shows how far right the Republican Party has become, that they can characterize him as this terrifying communist.
And how do you think it would work? We know that with Clinton, there was a parallel kind of standoff with Congress, wasn't there, where the Republican House closed down federal government and lights went off in various buildings.
Yeah.
And the blame game last time round was very much seen as being won by Clinton in the end, I think.
Well, also, Clinton was in a slightly stronger position because the economy was so much better then. So it was a different area. But I think Obama is in a much stronger position now than he was in his first term, because he has been so, you know, as Peter says, the election will be seen as a mandate for him, and he's been validated. And I think the American populace, even though he only won by 2% of the popular vote, I think he has been given an extra boost by the vote, by the election, basically.
And if the Republicans in the House say, well, we won the election too, we won the general election for Congress, do you think that wouldn't go down well with most voters?
No, not really, because I think most voters, you know, as Peter said, you know, the view of Congress is pretty low at this point by most American people, whereas the view of Obama is much more positive, despite whatever the far right and Fox News would say.
And so, Larry, let's assume for the moment that your worldview wins out over Russ Roberts, and the majority in Congress do decide it's better to avoid these big tax rises right now. What sort of deal do you think you would get struck? Do you think that Obama will compromise very close to the Republican position as he did last time he was negotiating with them over public debt? Or do you think he'll be able to force them into going easy on Medicaid and Medicare and put more of the emphasis on tax rises?
Well, two-thirds of the planned tightening come from tax increases. So in total, it's about $600 billion is supposed to be taken out of the economy this year, which about two-thirds is tax increases. So I imagine that there will be some sort of grand bargain done at some point whereby Obama allows some of those tax increases to be deferred, and in return the House will have to accept that some of the spending cuts that are planned will also have to be deferred. I think that will be the shape of the bargain, and that Obama will protect the bits of spending that he badly wants to protect. Health and Social Security, I would imagine, will be the two red lines for Obama. I mean, it will have consequences. I mean, if you go to America now, you know, you can see the sort of shabby state of their infrastructure, and quite clearly, you know, public investment is badly needed in highways and bridges, which are, you know, actually falling down in some cases. So if that bears the brunt of it, there will be costs to the American economy and to the American people also. So it's not even if Obama does ring fence health and Social Security, there will be consequences of this. And one other consequence may be that if the rating agencies think that essentially this is just a sort of squatted little deal which has kicked the can a bit further down the road, they may well respond by downgrading America's credit rating sometime in the new year. So there are quite big issues to be faced. It's not just a question of stitching up a deal between the White House and Capitol Hill that kicks the can down the road. There will be consequences if it looks like it's just a sort of cobbled together deal.
And Peter, finally, I mean, if we had a mix of people feeling the pinch from extra tax rises at the same time as maybe some cuts around the edges on Social Security and, of course, on healthcare, Medicaid, Medicare, that would sort of bring about an end to the hope we can change, we can believe in part two sort of mood of this week pretty quickly, wouldn't it?
No, very quickly indeed, I would imagine. I mean, people I know in the States at the moment, I mean, lots of them are, you know, they're struggling, and, you know, it's going to be more of a struggle. I mean, I think the cliff is actually a bad metaphor. It's a catch-22, and at the moment, it's kind of difficult to see how you get out with that much wriggle room from a problem that's been left to you, which is the sort of consequence of 10 years of very high defence spending because of two wars and tax cuts that were politically popular at the time, but have left it with sort of a time bomb inside the economy, really.
Well, thanks very much. That's all we've got time for. We'll be back to the bread and butter of British politics next week and the slightly less glitzy elections for police and crime commissioners in England and Wales. My thanks to Larry, to Hadley and Peter, as well as Russ Roberts and Paul Harris. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.